Welcome to the program for Friday, January 20th, 2011 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today it's the Federal News Countdown, as we do every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour. And what we do is two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work for the government, rank them in order from number 3 to number 1, and come into the studio and count them down with me on the Federal News Countdown. This week it is Dan Blair, the of Napa. You're the head cheese there. You're the big kahuna at Napa, and people are just saying great things about what you're doing there. I appreciate you being here today.
Well, thank you, Francis. Appreciate that.
And Robert Shea, principal at Grant Thornton and veteran of the Office of Management and Budget in Capitol Hill, also here in the countdown. It's good to see you as always, Robert.
Great to see you. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. I appreciate both of you being here on the countdown. And we start, of course, as we always do, with
number 3.
And as proof that I do not censor the stories of the countdown guests, the third most important federal news story of the week is chosen by Dan Blair, is from the Washington Post, and the headline is, "No self-respecting Redskins fan dares to root for the Ravens." I must ask you, Dan Blair, what were you thinking?
Come on, Francis. You need to engage your colleagues at the water cooler, because if everything this week, it hasn't been about federal news, it's about the Ravens. You saw Governor O'Malley, it's Purple Day. You hear it on the news. Are you going to root for the Ravens? Will the Redskins fans root for the Ravens? And I saw this and I thought, there are a lot of feds in Baltimore. There are lots of feds in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, I have a good friend, my friend Diane, who I worked with for a long time. She grew up in Baltimore, lives in Baltimore, grew up in Hamden, mm-hmm. in Baltimore. Ravens fan as far as you can go. Ravens fan to the bone.
Yes.
And her happiest weekend Sundays, her happiest Sundays are when the Ravens win, the Redskins lose, the Indianapolis Colts lose,
uh-huh.
because she's still mad that the
right.
Colts lost, and most people in Baltimore are too, that mm-hmm. they left Baltimore.
Yes.
And when the Cleveland Browns, who Baltimore stole from Cleveland,
yes.
loses as well.
What about
and
the Steelers?
You know, the Steelers...
This is a big
I think
rival.
They're number 5 for her.
Okay.
You know, they're right up there, but they're not like Washington. And when Washington wins and the Ravens win, well, the Ravens are good for her, but she just loves to see the Redskins lose. And so I'm thinking, what would my friend Diane do if the tables were turned and the Skins were in the playoffs
mm-hmm.
in the championship? And there's no way that she would be rooting for the Redskins. So I have to hand it to the Post article. No self-respecting Redskins fan dare roots for the Ravens.
Well, I have to say, I have to confess, Robert, this is a year that I finally gave up on the Redskins and went Ravens. And some of my Redskins, my wife not happy about that choice for one thing. But
I'm hurting that they beat my Houston Texans. But I look at Dan's story and I think, I never thought that my wife and Julius Rosenberg would have something in common. They rooted for the Giants. So at our house, we've all got Giants shirts on, so that's who we'll be rooting for.
Now, when you take it to the Giants, then that takes it back to another mildly federal angle. Did you see Vice President Biden went to San Francisco and was at this rally, and he thought he was charging people up, and he said, "I just want to tell you, the Giants are headed to the Super Bowl." And people started booing him because, of course, the football Giants are still in New York, and that's
yes,
the team
yeah.
that San Francisco happens to be playing on Sunday.
I feel equally oops. Vulnerable talking yeah. about sports. But
Well, it that was a funny oops moment, and I think he realized pretty quickly that he had just made a faux pas. It wasn't that he didn't know what was going on.
It wasn't just because he was Biden.
Well,
it was because he said that.
And he claimed later that it was because the baseball Giants are in San Francisco, and that's why he got him
yeah,
mixed up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Dan Blair, it's a great angle, and I appreciate you pointing this out as your most third
despite
most important
story.
Despite
the abuse, story. You just heaved at
Let
me.
Let me
but
just tell
okay,
you, if
Francis,
you think that's
okay.
abuse, you have not seen it yet. And
we'll wait till the next article.
Well, right? That's right. You keep choosing stories like this, you'll get some. But people have asked me from time to time, do I have any input or change around the stories that people submit for the show? And so this is Exhibit A that I don't do that. Robert Shea, your story number 3 on the Federal News Countdown this week is headlined, "Leading Democrat Expects Deal to Prevent Sequestration." The ranking member of the Appropriations Committee in the House, Norm Dix, says he thinks they're going to work it out. Is that a surprise to you?
It's a big debate. Right. Sequestration means we lose control. There's across-the-board cuts. They got to figure out how to find all that money. If they figure out a way around it, that means they have more control. Mm-hmm. They can allocate those funding cuts in a more responsible way. That's, you know, almost as big a debate as the Ravens versus Redskins. You know, where are these cuts going to come from? Are we going to avoid sequestration? It impacts DOD more than anybody else, so it's probably the debate is most focused over there. I expect when we get the budget in a couple of weeks, you'll see proposals that seek to avert the consequences of sequestration.
Now, we have our top story on federalnewsradio.com this afternoon is headlined, Obama to Press Congress to Revisit $1.2 trillion in Cuts, and it says that the president is going to ask Congress to find those cuts. What I wondered about when the story came out was, I would think if that's the case, they would be built into the request that he's going to submit starting beginning of February.
And I think they will, if not all, many of them will be.
Mm-hmm. Robert Chase, number three most important federal news story of the week is headlined, Leading Democrat Expects Deal to Prevent Sequestration. It is our Mike O'Connell's story about Congressman Norm Dix's comments that he believes Congress will step in and fix the sequestration problem. You can find that and all the stories that we're counting down today linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And we'll be back in a minute to check out story number two from Dan Blair and Robert Shea on the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Congress enacted legislation that requires $1.2 trillion in budget cuts before January 2013. But where and how will these cuts be made? Join host Jane Norris on Fed Central as Robin Leinberger, John Powers, and Joanne Boutel of Deloitte discuss strategies for reducing costs without significantly impacting core missions. Tune in to Deloitte's Fed Central, Wednesday, January 18th at 11:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. to learn more.
You can help the Army Historical Foundation honor the soldiers of yesterday and today. Go to armyhistory.org to learn how you can help build the National Museum of the U.S. Army. The museum will be the Army's national landmark, preserving the sacrifice of every man and woman who has worn the Army uniform since 1775. Visit armyhistory.org today and honor the Army service of every generation.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
As the government works to address the growing wave of cyber crime, one provider is leading the fight. Verizon stands as the first and only identity provider to achieve ICAM Level 3 approval. This enables Verizon to issue strong digital identity credentials that meet strict predefined standards to government agencies, health organizations, and businesses. It's one way Verizon is leading the fight against identity theft and fraud. To find out more, visit verizonbusiness.com/identity.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
The job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview. Yeah. And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station. Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. DOD and transportation are at odds with the FCC. The question is whether a wireless broadband deal will knock out GPS signals. Who's going to win this dispute and who decides? Plus, how exactly are small contractors doing now that the Pentagon is tightening its belt? Those stories and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Robert Shea and Dan Blair, the experts choosing the stories on the Federal News Countdown this week on In Depth with Francis Rose. And we're up to
number two.
Second most important federal news story of the week, as chosen by Dan Blair, is Julie Lee's story on federalnewsradio.com, headlined Citizen Satisfaction with Federal Services Slightly Up in 2011. Is this enough of an increase, 2.3%, to really get excited and puffy-chested about, do you think, Dan?
Well, I think it's a good trend line, and I think that that's important. I think that despite the fact that you hear about how disgruntled people are with government, that if this survey comes out and shows an increase in that, I think that shows you that people are appreciating the efforts that government does for them. It was interesting to go behind the article, though, and this was from your radio station, and to look at the actual survey itself. And it was really those agencies that had a lot of interaction with the public did the best. And so in this case, familiarity does not necessarily breed contempt. Rather, it breeds a higher degree of satisfaction. But you also pull up the trend lines. And this is something that I think that we need to work on. If you look at, we're at 66.9% this year, which 67%. That was up from 65.4% last year. But then the year before that, in 2009, it was at almost at 69%, same in 2008. And we hit a high of government customer satisfaction in 2006. So we really have a lot. We still have some more ground to gain. But this is good news. I think another aspect of this, which is interesting, because it just looked at the federal agencies, but it didn't cover a big chunk of the federal government, that's the Postal Service. And the Postal Service has been in the news lately. They're closing post offices. They're trying to close post offices. They're running billions of dollars in debt. But if you look at their satisfaction survey that came out from the same organization back in, I think it was June, they do quite well. They have a score of 79%. So it's just interesting to see how it's those agencies that touch people. And the more you touch them every day, the higher degree of satisfaction.
That makes sense on one hand, Robert, because you, if you don't have an experience with an agency, it's hard to get a sense of what they're doing and why they're doing it and how they're doing it. What do you look at when you see these numbers?
I see two things. I see TSA and or the Transportation Security Agency and the Internal Revenue Service get really low scores. Probably some of our higher performing workforces. We don't like them because our interaction with them isn't the most pleasant. But what they do is critical, collecting revenue and keeping our skies safe. Those are two groups of people that we ought to be really proud of and applaud their public service. But overall, handling complaints, government received a score of 44 out of 100. And if my daughters brought those grades home, there'd be some there'd be repercussions.
Yes.
So
conversation.
All of this is in the context of an administration's initiative to improve customer satisfaction, customer service throughout the government. So I don't know if that's taken hold, and this is a reflection of that, or that we just haven't had enough time under that initiative to see progress. But I hope people are taking this data seriously, using it as a benchmark to focus their customer service improvement efforts.
My takeaway from this was that this struck me the same as the surveys that people do about Congress all the time. Overall, Congress's ratings are in the toilet, but if you ask them about their particular person, they like that person generally. And this seemed to be the same concept, with the idea being that the agencies, as you said, Dan, the agencies that people have contact, well, all of them I don't care for, but I deal with Agency X and I like them. My experience with them is good.
I think to try to reconcile both your statements, if you look at the agencies that actually deliver benefits, you'll see them having higher scores. If it's an unpopular task, such as a pat down at an airport, they may be doing it very well and keeping us safe in the skies, but it's not a desired activity, so you'll see lower scores in that. It's interesting with the IRS, they broke it down between those who file electronically versus taxpayers who file on paper. Those who had who did it electronically had a satisfaction score of 78. Those who did it to paper had a 57 score. So it's kind of interesting to see how they break it down and see what that customer satisfaction is.
And IRS has been pushing really hard, especially in the last 3 or 4 years, to get people to file electronically.
To your point on who people like the best, the survey sites, the Small Business Administration, people who borrowed money from them, the National Weather Service, I mean, our weather reports are that's the source of our weather report, something we rely on all the time. Then the Bureau of Consular Affairs at the State Department, if you're getting a passport, you generally can get it pretty quick, and the service is pretty good.
Now, you mentioned the Postal Service not included in this, Dan. And as a former member of the Postal Rate Commission, you know that organization fairly intimately. What do they do that maybe other agencies aren't doing that could help improve this perception?
Well, I think what they're doing is they're touching the public every day, and they're giving the public something they want. It's their mail. It's a moment in your household time in which you're receiving communication from the outside, and generally they want to enhance that. People tend to like their letter carriers. They'll speak to them on the street. So the Postal Service generally has, and people almost take an iconic view of their individual post offices. But we've seen, though, over the last few years that they're bleeding red ink. They're billions of dollars in debt. What's interesting is that as they touch the individual recipient 6 days a week. And the polls that the Postal Service has taken has shown that you reduce that to 5 days a week, people really don't care that much. Now, a lot of the businesses do, however. But you get a different reaction when you try to close someone's post office. It's more visceral reaction. Even if you don't use that post office, people still seem to see that as inherently linked with the community. And that is one of the tougher aspects of the Postal Service's efforts to rein in its footprint and its costs, that they're seeing that kind of backlash from the public.
Robert, where do you start if you're in an agency and you really do want to take this kind of information seriously and try to enhance customer service? I mean, is it the same as customer service in the private sector?
Absolutely. In many cases, it's precisely the same. First of all, you got to figure out who your customer is. You got to survey them again, find out a little bit more explicitly what their complaints are, what they like, what they don't like, and then undertake serious efforts to fix those problems and consistently ask your customer whether or not what they're getting is meeting their expectations. And it's, you know, customer satisfaction is one thing, but customer service, the speed and effectiveness with which we serve the American people is where we ought to be focusing our attention. That's where the administration's initiative is focused. I think it's in the right place.
Dan Blair, story number two on the countdown this week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is Citizen Satisfaction with Federal Services Slightly Up in 2011. That's our Jolie Lee's story, and you can find it linked up with all of our countdown stories today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Robert Shays, second most important federal news story of the week when the countdown continues on In Depth with Francis Rose.
On the move but need your CAPS info? CAPS Mobile lets you use your mobile phone to stay connected to the CAPS. Receive breaking news and special offers by text message. Check live scores and stats with a CAPS mobile app. Enter text to win contests for great CAPS prizes and much more. To join the CAPS mobile club, text CAPS to 43803 now. For more info on all CAPS mobile offerings, visit the Fan Zone section of WashingtonCAPS.com. Stay CAPS connected with CAPS Mobile.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7222.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
With the new year comes resolutions, when we resolve to stop snacking and slacking, resolve to start reading and running. This year, resolve to help someone else, too. Resolve to support the American Red Cross, because the Red Cross provides hope, help, and compassion not only during disasters, but every day. Resolve to do something that means something. Support the American Red Cross before the new year. Visit redcross.org today.
Join host Michael Keegan for a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on leadership and public service. What makes an effective leader? Why pursue a career in public service? Over a dozen past and current government executives shared their extended reflection on the next Business of Government Hour.
Commit to quit. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Charles Kopis with HHS HealthBeat. Nearly 7 in 10 smokers say they want to quit, but fewer than one of them will do so successfully this year. Committing can be hard, but support can help. From a friend, counseling, medication, and your health care provider, the best medicine to help you clear the habit, all of the above. Dr. Ann Mahler-Shea of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The combination of both medication and counseling is the most effective for quitting smoking, and they double or triple your chances of quitting. Counseling does work, including individual, group, and telephone counseling.
Quitting has immediate health benefits and reduces your risk of cardiovascular disease. An article on quitting smoking is in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Charles Kopis.
Government financial managers are committed to produce timely, reliable, and useful financial information. Stay on top of issues that affect you at AGA's 10th Annual National Leadership Conference, February 16th and 18th at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. AGA's NLC features the latest tools and innovations to help agencies do their jobs more easily and more effectively. Don't miss it. Register today at agacgfm.org/NLC.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week includes the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by this week's experts, Robert Shea of Grant Thornton and Dan Blair of NAPA. And we are up to number two, Robert Shea's second most important federal news story of the week from NextGov. And the headline is OMB tasks 11 agencies with documenting duplication. And I have to confess, knowing you as I do, when I read this story, I thought you were the first person that came to my mind. And I thought, I wonder what he thinks of this. And now you can tell me.
That's right. You can tell me. You're a giant in the business. And you could just go to the source. So my thought on this was, we had an announcement of a reorganization with great fanfare at the President's State of the Union last year.
Mm-hmm.
And people waited for an announcement with great anticipation, which came last week as well.
Mm-hmm.
But soon following that was this memo that said, we're going to spend the next year inventorying these programs. which begs the question, well, if you're going to reorganize these agencies, you've got that plan, but you haven't inventoried them. Is it really going to take a year to inventory these programs? And didn't GAO do this inventory? Don't we have a lot of sources? It just seems a little bureaucratic to take this much time to identify the problem when so many people have recommended solutions.
Now, this you're not the only person that holds that view. The story quotes Thomas Schatz, the president of Citizens Against Government Waste, a think tank, an activist group that's been around D.C. for a long time, who says this should exist already. How can you decide how to consolidate agencies if you don't know the full extent of the duplication? I imagine this is something that you and your colleagues at NAPA have been all over too, Dan.
Actually, as Robert and I were discussing earlier, the Academy hosted a discussion of this back in February.
That's right, right after the State of the Union.
Right after the president had announced that. And there's a lot of effort and energy towards this. I'll tell you that we cannot continue to do things in government the way that we did it over the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
We have a government organization and structure that's up to date to 1948 and doesn't reflect the priorities or the necessities of a 21st century government. So we're going to have to do things differently. Combine that with the fact, and we talked about this earlier in the article that Robert brought on the threat of sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to make these kinds of cuts and still deliver on the types of government programs and services that citizens expect, how are we going to do that? And we're going to need to take a whole new look at government. One way of doing this is to take a holistic look across the board and identify governmental functions and identify how many of these departments and agencies perform many of the same operations.
Mm-hmm.
And look for duplication along those lines. Duplication may be intentional. There may be a good reason to have one, two, three, or four agencies doing similar things. But if there's going to be duplication, let's make sure it's intentional and it's not by way of happenstance, which I believe most often it occurs. Robert mentioned earlier there was a really important GAO report that came out on this
mm-hmm.
last year, and I know that the House is looking at reorganization efforts as well. I think that the more discussion about this, the better it is. Now, will this take place in terms of a political year like we're seeing? I don't know, but the Congress and the administration are going to have to work hard to decide how we're going to meet the goals of these cuts. And if we're going to make these cuts, you just can't do across-the-board cuts because you're going to, as I said earlier, you nick not only fat, but you take off bone and muscle as well, and it's going to lead to program failure. You need to decide now what programs you need to have, what programs are working, which ones are required by law, which ones are required by regulation, which ones are required by practice, and target those as well as the high-performing ones, and triage that
mm-hmm.
in order to achieve the kinds of cuts that we have. And reorganizing and looking at the whole of government is one of the first ways of starting this.
Now, we've talked about this before, Robert, 1,000 times, and the Obama administration is trying it this way. You had a way of trying it in the Bush administration. Vice President Gore led an effort in the Clinton administration. You could probably identify somebody in every administration, no matter how far back you went.
They all failed.
Why is that?
Well, because it's hard in our political system to get stuff through the president and the Congress. I think there's pretty wide agreement that this needs to be done, that we need to reduce duplication, consolidate programs to save money and improve our performance. But to get the Congress and both houses of Congress and the president to agree on a reorganization proposal is very tough. What I think we have an opportunity to do now, in this election year, one of the few areas of potential compromise, is to come up with a framework around which the president can reorganize the government. You've got a Republican Congress advocating smaller government. They don't know who the next president will be. Why don't we bet that the next president will be our guy and give the president the authority to reorganize?
Mm-hmm. That's a nice thought. I think the odds of that happening, is there a number less than zero? Would be my guess.
I was told there'd be no math. I don't know. I'm a little bit more optimistic that wisdom will prevail and folks will see that that we're at a point in time where we haven't been able to do this before, and it needs to be done. And a Republican Congress giving a Democratic president this authority, I think it's more likely in this situation than in others.
Dan, I probably shouldn't say this to two veterans of Capitol Hill, but nobody ever went broke overestimating the wisdom of Congress. Is that right?
Well, I think you need to look at what were successful efforts in this regard and take from that what the lessons learned were. And in this case, I think if you're going to have this type of substantial government reorganization, you need to have buy-in. You need to make sure that it can be institutionalized and that it can survive not just one or two, but it can survive multiple presidential administrations mm-hmm. and multiple Congresses. This is going to take something where Republicans and Democrats in the administration have to come to some fundamental agreement. Frankly, if we can't come to some fundamental agreement, we're going to be up a creek in trying to meet these goals of the sequestration mm-hmm. and these other cuts coming down the line. You know, if you take a holistic look at this across government, there are ways of preserving the programs that are delivered to the citizens, which some groups will want to do at all costs. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you can do it by also streamlining and saving money. So there is some common ground here. Will it be done this year? I don't know. This is a highly politicized year, but at least you can lay the groundwork for something like this.
Mm-hmm.
I think then in the next year, 2013, 2014, will be critical years. If the president is reelected, the administration is going to be looking at what their legacy is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a Republican Congress, they're going to be looking at self-preservation and trying to get reelected. And if you look at the most productive years of the Clinton administration, when they reached the balanced budget agreement and did a whole host of legislating, mm-hmm. it was that year after President Clinton was reelected in 1997 and 1998, before the scandals hit.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll remember 1997, Congress adjourned, I think it was October 1st, and was out until mid-February. And so you can reach that sweet spot when you appeal to their when you make an appeal that can benefit both of them, it can be a joint victory. In this case, trying to shave costs and deliver on government programs could be that sweet spot.
Robert Chase, second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec and NextGov. The headline is OMB tasks 11 agencies with documenting duplication, and you can read it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news story of the week, as chosen by Robert Shea and by Dan Blair, when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Giving you the edge on healthy living, here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge. The trembling, shaking, twisting, or slowness of movement can make everyday chores, everyday pleasures impossible. But some patients with movement disorders like Parkinson's disease, essential tremor, or dystonia are finding relief with deep brain stimulation. Mayo Clinic Dr. Jerry Evidente says you can think of it as
a brain pacemaker.
You see, those movements are caused by abnormal electrical signals in parts of the brain. Deep brain stimulation uses mild electric shocks to short-circuit or jam those abnormal brain signals, reducing or even stopping the movement disorder. Deep brain stimulation, or DBS, is not for everyone, and it's not without risk. Plus,
this is not a cure. It will not make your condition disappear.
But it can improve a patient's symptoms and quality of life. For more information, talk to your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Vivian Williams.
Hi, this is Byron Kerr. I know it's great to listen to me tell you all about the shaking and baking and thunder jams of Colonials men's basketball on Federal News Radio, but there's nothing like seeing it live at the Charles E. Smith Center. Come to Foggy Bottom with the whole family to raise high the buff and blue and enjoy great college hoops against some of the country's most exciting teams at a great price. I'll still be around for road games, so visit gwsports.com or call 202-994-7325 to raise high the buff and blue today.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
Stephen Van Roekel is the federal CIO.
How are you alleviating any concerns that you may be hearing from Congress about cloud and the cost-benefit for the government?
Two big things I'm doing there is, one is I'm spending a lot of personal time talking to Congress about what the benefits are here, and it's carrying forward data. You know, the key here is showing people the real live data. And if you think about cost-benefit analysis, it comes down to people, it comes down to reoccurring costs.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Want the latest Department of Defense news? Listen every Wednesday for DoD Wednesday on Federal News Radio. Wednesday afternoons at 2, Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. Then stick around Wednesday afternoons at 3 when in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a deep dive into the issues and challenges of the defense community. All this plus our daily DoD updates at 40 past the hour, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week includes the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dan Blair of Napa and Robert Shea of Grant Thornton. And we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dan Blair, is from Federal Computer Week. And the headline is, how real is the threat of disgruntled feds jumping to industry? Now, this is the track that we hear all the time, is the people in the government who are really good will leave and they will go to work for contractors, and they will come back to the government and work and do the same thing they were doing, only they'll cost more because they're working for a contractor. What do you see there? What does that make sense to you from your perspective?
Well, what I see with this article is that, you know, a series of threats of budget cuts, benefit cuts, and pay freezes has really led to some, you know, to a high degree of dissatisfaction with employment among federal employees. The question is going to be, is there something for them to jump to? And would it be prudent in today's environment to leave your job without another job? And I think those are critical questions. But you combine this with this retirement wave that looks like it's starting to hit now.
Mm-hmm.
The article said that, you know, more than 100,000 federal employees are expected to leave, you know, that retirees, along with the usual retirees, look at a significant number who are looking for better opportunities. It's going to be interesting. OPM has announced its new plan to hire a significant number of new employees to process these retirements. So it looks like we've been talking since 1999, when GAO first came out with the human capital crisis,
mm-hmm.
about these feds leaving. And it looks like, especially with a pay freeze, and most of these feds are under the old retirement system, that they're looking at it going, it's not worth it for me to continue to stay here because it's not helping me in terms of my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But, Francis, I don't always follow your rules. And so I wanted to combine that with the second article that kind of leads into that. And that this is by Alan Balutis, who's actually an Academy Fellow.
A good friend of the show.
And this was in Washington Business Journal. And his article was, a new wave of federal workers is poised to emerge. And he talks about how this retirement wave can give way to, it's a healthy change. And that an unprecedented level of baby boomers heading towards retirement is a tremendous opportunity that he embraces. And so I thought this was interesting, but I wanted to ask Robert that in this article from Federal Computer Week, it said that according to an analysis by USA Today, death was a greater threat than layoffs, and mentioned such agencies as OMB. And Robert, you didn't die, and you left OMB, so maybe I'm confused.
I felt like I died.
I'm confused.
The turnover rate in government has generally, historically, been very low. And you're right that the current environment suggests, if you're talking about reasonable people, that it will it will increase. More people leave government willingly than they have in the past. And you see this with early retirements, buyouts of all kinds. I think you all track buyouts on your
website.
Yeah,
the buyout guide is on federalnewsradio.com.
Right. I do think you're going to see an unusual increase in this, and hopefully overtaking death as one of the reasons people leave government.
Now, Mike Causey has the opinion that the buyouts and early outs will peak in like March, maybe at beginning of April, because after that they lose their effectiveness as a budgeting tool. do you think that's accurate? You agree with that?
I'm not sure. Dan would probably be better to answer that question than I.
I'm not aware of that, and I think that Mike Causey would be a good source for that kind of information. It depends on what the agencies are facing. If they are facing some kind of across-the-board cuts by way of a sequestration, and if these are buyouts in lieu of laying people off, that may come in June or July or whatever. So I don't disagree with what he said, but we're in a different environment right now. One of the things I wanted to point out in this article that was interesting is it said more than 100,000 federal employees are expected to leave government this year. Well, I'm not any good at math either, but we have about 2.1 million, and this is 100,000 employees. And so what is that, roughly 5%?
Sounds about right, yeah. So 200,000 would be 10%, so yes.
So a little bit less than 5%. So how is a 5% turnover in a workforce like this?
How does that compare to the private sector, I wonder?
It is lower than the private sector, and it is a perfectly manageable turnover rate in a well-run human capital
system. So is it just scary because it's a higher number than federal government people are used to?
And the system is broken, right? The hiring system is broken. The ability to retain people, the most talented people, is broken. I think our system is not structured to be nimble, and so the ability for agencies to respond quickly to this spike in turnover is not good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think agencies can respond, but I think that the key consideration here is the economy. That if you have talented people in the federal government, hardworking, and opportunities arise in the private sector, they may be the ones that jump. If they're seeing their pay frozen or that their performance is not being recognized, and we know we have a pay system that's not geared towards that, then I think you may see this brain drain. But if the economy continues to be sluggish, the federal government is a very stable employer, and that you don't have those spikes in layoffs. We just saw today that one of the big consulting firms in town laying off, I think, 100 and some employees. And you don't really see so much of that in government. Occasionally you'll have these rifts coming down the pike, et cetera. But the federal government is a very stable employer. But because of the pay freezes and threats of benefit cuts, your more able workers, if the economy improves and the job market improves, may just make that jump.
That is Dan Blair of NAPA, and his first most important federal story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is, How Real is the Threat of Disgruntled Feds Jumping to Industry? And it's posted now on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, linked up for you to read anytime you want. Robert Shea is the other expert on the Federal News Countdown this week. His number one story next to wrap up today's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday at 10 a.m. here on Federal News Radio. This week, my special guest is Caroline Adams Miller, an amazing coach and a best-selling author of Creating Your Best Life, The Ultimate Life List Guide. Tune in to listen to Caroline. The show is brought to you by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Vienna, Virginia. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
In the beloved fairy tale, Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly 1 in 3 children in America are overweight or obese.
Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov, brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Ad Council.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
That 0.5% pay raise that President Obama is proposing won't come without a fight. Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings, a Democrat, says he supports the raise, but the idea is not popular among House Republicans. We're just going to have to fight it tooth and nail, he tells Federal News Radio. A station poll shows federal employees had mixed reactions themselves to the idea. Half of respondents said they found the 0.5% hike insulting.
When did you last review your life insurance coverage? WEPA, a nonprofit association founded in 1943, provides life insurance to federal employees at rates significantly less than the federal program. WEPA also has a premium refund policy that's returned over $58 million to its policyholders since 1996. WEPA gives its policyholders more coverage, more benefits, and greater flexibility, yet costs much less. Visit WAEPA.org to learn about all of your options. Again, that's WAEPA.org.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
Human Capital Management for Defense is a highly anticipated training conference with over 300 delegates and key speakers, such as Lieutenant General Daryl D. Jones, Deputy Chief of Staff for Manpower, Personnel and Services, U.S. Air Force, Honorable Thomas R. Lamont, Assistant Secretary of the Army, Manpower and Reserve Affairs, and Honorable Juan M. Garcia, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Manpower and Reserve Affairs. This year's event will be held on March 12th through the 15th at the Sheraton National Hotel in Arlington. For more info, visit hcmdusa.com. Mention code FNR for a 25% discount.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose. We're on the Federal News Countdown this week with Robert Shea and with Dan Blair. And Robert, your number one story, most important federal news story of the week, is from NextGov. The headline is Pentagon Cedes Control of Defense Cyber Pilot to DHS. What struck you about this one? Because you're not normally a tech or cyber guy.
My computer got a virus recently. No, I'm kidding. The first three words of the story jumped out at me. Pentagon cedes control.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unnatural act for the Pentagon, but you know they're ceding control in Iraq. They're going to withdraw from Afghanistan. Now they're giving their cyber pilot to DHS. What is going on? I just think it's an important indicator of the times, where we are going to have to shed things that aren't critical to our mission. Cybersecurity attacks on our computer systems are, by all analysis, one of the major priorities of the defense of our nation right now.
Mm-hmm.
Attacks are constant and vicious. They are being instigated by our foreign governments. And so it is a big deal. Hopefully DHS is up to the task.
And this story says the Homeland Security Department's taking over a heralded Pentagon project that shared classified intelligence with select military contractors and their communications providers, DHS officials said. The whole story, of course, is linked up at federalnewsradio.com. But this is rather unusual for the Pentagon to give away anything to anybody. My first thought was, who told him to do it? Am I too cynical, Dan?
Of course not, Francis. Of course not. What I thought was interesting here was, Robert said it, agencies shedding programs are not integral to the core. That seems to be an alien concept here in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's one that we're going to have to familiarize ourselves with.
Mm-hmm.
because as we go through these budget cuts, we're going to have to decide what an agency can and cannot do. And an agency is going to have to preserve and protect its core missions while shedding those other responsibilities, because it just, we're not, there's not the money there that can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in this one, while it may be a natural act, if it's not, it's integral to their mission, this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we should, you know, hopefully this will herald more agencies transferring functions to other departments or agencies that are not integral to their core. And this may be a way of attacking some of these budget problems.
So, Robert, could you see, or would you like to see at some level, consolidation to the point where there is one agency, maybe a bureau inside Homeland Security, that's responsible, say, for cybersecurity across the entire government space, where each agency is no longer responsible because, theoretically at least, and I'm making an argument here, not a policy statement or an opinion, but an argument could be made that the Department of fill-in-the-blank's mission is not specifically directed towards securing a network, but rather fulfilling whatever the mission is to serve the citizen. And so somebody else could do that. It would be inside government, so you don't get into the whole inherently governmental argument. Does that make sense, or is that something that you think should exist?
I know there's politics around where the leadership of cybersecurity resides, which I don't have a dog in that fight.
Mm-hmm.
But a critical ingredient in the recipe for success is assigning responsibility. Leadership over the enterprise must be clear. And so if centralizing that at DHS is how you get there, then I think yes.
Look, you know, one question I want to ask is this a signal that DHS is getting its sea legs? Now, when we went through this whole DHS effort mm-hmm. in 2002, 2003, you know, we knew this was going to take a long time for, you know, cobbling these 24-plus disparate departments, agencies, and offices together to make it effective. And hopefully this may be a sign that is becoming more effective if you're transferring from DOD to DHS a critical program like this.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, it took DOD, 40 years or plus to bring together, and it took the Goldwater-Nichols legislation to mm-hmm. really bring that back together. That was in the 80s. And so it was a long time in integrating the services together within DOD, and DHS was supposed to be a monumental task. It is a monumental task, but hopefully this may be a sign that DHS is getting its sea legs.